Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Christy Rosa. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Onc Live is also home to the State of the Science Summits. These summits, which take place throughout the United States, are dedicated to the latest research in various therapeutic areas. That brings us to today's episode. We recently traveled to Seattle, Washington for a State of the Science Summit on hematologic malignancies. At the meeting, faculty from the Seattle Cancer Care Alliance provided insight on current and evolving standards of care in leukemia, lymphoma, and myeloma, highlighting particular targets of interest for novel therapies. First, we spoke with the chair of the meeting, Gerald Radich, MD, a member in the Clinical Research Division at Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, a professor in the Division of Medical Oncology at the University of Washington School of Medicine, and a physician with the Seattle Cancer Care Alliance. There are several ways to assess minimal residual disease in patients with acute lymphoblastic leukemia, explained Radich. And although there is some debate as to whether it should be termed minimal or measurable, it may become standard practice to test for MRD as a surrogate endpoint in clinical trials. Listen on to hear Radich discuss the methods that are being used to measure MRD, as well as the work that's being done to standardize its use in ALL.
Right now, there are three methods that are used. There is one which is looking at the immunoglobulin or the TCR receptor changes that happen in either B or T cells, and doing essentially a patient-specific PCR assay based on whatever specific VDG clone rearrangement is in that leukemia. The advantage of that is you have a patient-specific marker which tends to be fairly sensitive. You can actually detect one leukemia cell down to 10,000, sometimes even down to maybe one in a million. The con side is it actually takes a long time. It takes a number of days. It's very expensive. It's very labor intensive. And the sensitivities really vary patient to patient. So while we say the sensitivity is generally one leukemic cell in 10 to 1,000, you might get lucky in one patient and it's one in a million just because of the VDJ particulars of that rearrangement, as opposed to one in 1,000 in another one, right? The Europeans use this mostly as their way of measuring MRD. In the US, we've used mostly flow cytometry to measure MRD. That's looking at the constellation of antigens distribution on leukemic cells and trying to look at patterns of those antigens that are different from normal. The advantage of that is that it's very fast. You really get the turnaround in really a day. But there's really a fair amount of art to it, and it really, the sensitivities and performance varies dramatically from lab to lab. So it's really very hard to get standardized, but that's kind of what has been the usual method in the United States. What's going to be taking over soon, I'm sure, is next generation sequencing, which is like the approach that I talked about before with the VDJ rearrangements. But instead of patient-specific amplification strategies, you're basically just using multiple different primers, hundreds of primers, and just taking that patient's VDJ from that and doing thousands of PCR reactions in one small tube and looking what the gene sequence is that's the fingerprint of the leukemia in that particular patient. That has the advantage of being standardizable. I mean, the FDA is very interested in that. It's now been FDA approved. The downside is it takes longer to do than the other assays because it's brute force sequencing and therefore it's more expensive. The main thing we are going to need is FDA regulatory buy-off. And preliminarily about last year, based on our data, they suggested that they thought this would be a potential surrogate for an endpoint in analysis, which means that you could use that at a very early time point, 3 months, 6 months, to declare which drug might be better and might want to carry forward to a phase three trial. They've been doing some work on their own, and I think that they're coming to a conclusion where that might be the case. If that's so, that will change everything quickly because people will start looking at early phase two trials as really ways to using MRD as the actual endpoint of the trial. And once that happens, the amount of investment in technologies from industry, biotech, to build a better mousetrap, from pharma, because they would save bazillions of dollars making clinical trials faster and being able to send more drugs to the pipeline. Once that all happens, this is going to take flight really, really fast in a powerful way. And that will just really drag all the diseases that are a little bit behind in technologies to measure MRD right up front. So this is going to be really the strong horse that pulls the big cart.
Afterward, Mazyar Shadman, MD, MPH, an assistant member in the Clinical Research Division of Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, sat down with us to discuss CAR T-cells. Now that the CD19-targeted CAR T-cell therapies exicabtagene ciloleucel and tisagenlecleucel have shown durable responses in the relapsed refractory settings of non-Hodgkin lymphoma, researchers are hopeful that earlier exposure may heighten the curative potential of this modality, explained Shadman. In our interview, Shadman, who is also an assistant professor at the University of Washington and an attending physician with Seattle Cancer Care Alliance, discussed earlier use of CAR T-cell therapy in lymphoma, the impact of approved products on future development, and recent data with chemotherapy-free and time-limited therapy in CLL.
Of course, great results in the lymphoma world. Of course, we now have two CAR T constructs that target CD19 as a target, and they're both approved for diffuse large B-cell lymphoma or similar histologies in the relapse setting in patients after two lines of treatment, and we are seeing great responses. We have reasonable follow-up now showing that some of those responses are durable. Now, like anything else in oncology, it's time to bring this treatment to the earlier lines of treatment, and I think that would be the focus for example, large cell lymphoma. It has been the focus in the past few years, and there are studies that try to test this very effective treatment in the second line setting. As you know, the second line treatment for large cell lymphoma is still chemoimmunotherapy followed by high dose treatment and stem cell transplant and autologous transplant. So the question is, could we do better by doing CAR T instead of that? So there are randomized studies that are investigating that possibility, and I think that's very exciting. And for example, some of the JCAR 17 or Lysocell, which is a CAR T that's not approved yet, but we are actively participating in study that is looking that opportunity. Same thing for first line. So we have now studies with, for example, these are just examples, of course, with Axi-cel or Yescarta in the first line setting in high-risk patients, high-risk diffuse large B-cell lymphoma patients who are defined to be high risk by different definitions, and if they don't achieve a complete remission after a few cycles of therapy, then we go with CAR T right there instead of waiting until they fail two or three lines of treatment. So really it talks about the efficacy and also the toxicity of these treatments. To bring some treatment to earlier line of therapy for a curable disease is important, and we're happy to see this happening in this field. Other diseases are moving or following diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, follicular lymphoma. We had a few small subgroup reports at the ASCO meeting last week on mantle cell lymphoma, some small subgroups with secondary CNS lymphoma. I think these are very important. And of course, other trials targeting more than CD19. There are studies that target CD19, CAR Ts that target both CD19 and 20, for example, or at Fred Hutch, we have in-house CAR T targeting CD20 that we're very excited about. So looking at different indications in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, looking at new histologies, looking at different targets, there's a lot of work to do. And at the end, the goal is to have the patient benefit from cure for most of these lymphomas. Last year, if I had a patient who had an option of receiving chemoimmunotherapy or an oral drug like ibrutinib, the reason why some patients would go with a chemoimmunotherapy option is the fact that it's a fixed duration of treatment, and after 6 months or so, they will enjoy the remission that could last for years, right? So now we have a drug that's not chemotherapy and also gives you the opportunity of maybe having a fixed duration of treatment. The reason that I say maybe is the fact that the studies are designed both in the first line setting, like the CLL14 study or like Murano study, which was presented and published now 2 years ago, the studies were designed to give venetoclax in combination with the CD20 antibody for 1 or 2 years respectively, which is great. We really don't know what happens after these patients stop treatment. For second line setting in the Murano study, we have some short-term follow-up, and there are promising results that if our patients achieve a deep remission. They may be relapse-free for a long time, but the follow-up is relatively short. So, but just the fact that we hope that we can get to that treatment-free and disease-free time is very promising. We never thought about it with BTK inhibitors or PI3 kinase inhibitors. These drugs are just not designed to give us deep remissions that could translate to long-term remissions, but venetoclax could do it in theory. We need to wait and see longer follow-up, but yes, it's important for a patient, it's important for a physician to have a patient who's not receiving treatment and doing great. It's important for the health system to have a limited duration of treatment, so that would be the goal.
Even if a patient with chronic myeloid leukemia qualifies for TKI discontinuation, it does not mean that they're out of the woods, explained Vivian G. Oler, MD, an associate member in the Clinical Research Division of the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, who added that monitoring becomes even more important in this context. When Oler, who is also an associate professor of medicine at the University of Washington School of Medicine and a physician with Seattle Cancer Care Alliance, sat down with us, she discussed the important aspects of TKI discontinuation and the patient factors that would warrant such an approach. Moreover, she highlighted ongoing developments in myeloproliferative neoplasms and shared her hopes for the future in light of the number of emerging drugs that are showing promise as monotherapy and in combination in clinical trials.
For those who have excellent molecular responses with deep molecular responses or major molecular response, the question then becomes, are there strategies that we can use to improve quality of life? And so tonight I'm talking about TKI cessation, and then for those patients who may not be candidates for that, some of the data that we have on dose de-escalation to minimize symptoms. For most of the studies that have been run abroad and here in the US, the general criteria for TKI cessation include being on TKI for at least 3 years and having a deep molecular response of 2 years or longer, although ongoing studies in Europe with the EuroSCI study require only a deep molecular response at MR4 for less than 1 year. And we also want to have a transcript that we know is one that we have measured accurately over time, so a P210 transcript. Also patients who are chronic phase, and monitoring is actually critical. We know that for patients who stop TKI that about 50% of them will have molecular relapse requiring restart of TKI, and that 85% of that group will actually relapse within the first 6 months. But we also know that late relapses can occur, and so given the wonderful prognosis that CML patients might have, we want to make sure not to miss those patients. Probably one of the most common consults that I get. I think over the years I've found that the patients who have been on TKIs for the longest and remember the old days, so to speak, of CML treatment have been a little bit more reluctant to stop. Additionally, here in the US we didn't really have any clinical trials for them, and we're doing perhaps stopping them on our own with close monitoring a la what they were doing abroad. On the other hand, we have patients who are starting now who are very eager. In my own panel, I have a number of young patients who might not have completed family planning, and so getting to a deep response so that they can complete all of that is really important. And so the patients who come are really quite interested, so it's usually not the other way around, although there are patients out there who are curious about why it might be possible for them to remain off of therapy. And I think at this point, although we think the immune microenvironment has something to do with it, our understanding of that still remains unclear. So interferon is certainly an excellent therapy that we have used in PV and ET for a number of years. Its mechanism of action still remains a little bit unclear, whether it changes the we know it changes the cytokine milieu, whether it could potentially target an MPN stem cell is unclear. I do think the PROUD-PV and its continuation study did show some interesting data in abstract format where it looked like over time complete hematologic responses were increasing in years 2 and 3, as well as perhaps a decrease in the burden of the JAK2 at the molecular level. However, we know from the studies here in the US with the MPD-RC112 study that they looked pretty much the same and that there wasn't an improvement, and perhaps there were increased side effects in patients who received pegylated interferon. So I do think it's a a therapy that can be considered for patients, and I think a better understanding of its mechanism of action and how we select which patients to treat will help us in deciding who to treat with this agent.
With the development of new agents in benign hematologic disorders and more in the pipeline, the outlook for patients with aplastic anemia, immune thrombocytopenia, and thrombotic thrombocytopenic purpura has brightened considerably. Listen on to hear Kleiber Yodomoto Furton, MD, PhD, an assistant professor at the University of Washington School of Medicine and a physician with Seattle Cancer Care Alliance, shed light on the new options that have emerged in the treatment landscape of benign hematologic malignancies.
The data that I'm going to show definitely define that adding the TPO mimetics, these new class of drugs, that the overall response is much higher in patients that use it upfront. And you can even glimpse at the fact that the earlier you introduce that, the better. So it's definitely moving forward to the first line of therapy. The best study in with these drugs show almost double the overall response in these patients. So I think it's safe to say that it's a very dramatic improvement. I think we don't know yet how far this can get. And the second thing is, in aplastic anemia, we're dealing with three different lineages that are impaired, and even if we thought that TPO mimetics were meant to improve only platelet counts, we can see that the overall response for all three lineages happen. So that's I think, the most striking advantage of this treatment. Starting with TTP, this is a disease that first it was almost 100% lethal, and then with the development of plasma exchange, things improved a lot, but we did not have an expectation that we could improve a lot the way we see with the new drug with caplacizumab. In short, it shortens the length of stay in hospital, and that has dramatic implications for cost and for quality of life of these patients. We still have yet to see what it does to long-term outcomes and to the quality of life these patients have, but we know that this is definitely like a very welcome drug for a disease that had very few options of treatment. For ITP, even though it's not as severe as TTP, what we see is the patients that are stuck with chronic ITP did not have a lot of options 10 years ago. And now we reached the point where we have three, maybe four different drugs to choose from. And these patients will now be able to choose a more appropriate treatment for each case. I think we finally have an array of drugs that allows patients more options and maybe achieve a better quality of life living with this disease.
When it comes to multiple myeloma, combination regimens, especially in the form of triplet and quadruplet regimens, are the future of treatment, explained Andrew J. Cowan, MD, who cited the results of the Phase 3 Cassiopeia and Maya trials as examples. Listen on to hear Cowan, an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Washington School of Medicine and physician with Seattle Cancer Care Alliance, discuss pivotal trials in multiple myeloma and the potential for new treatments in the future.
Treatment strategies are different only in whether or not we include transplant or not. I think increasingly, three drug regimens, including a proteasome inhibitor and an immunomodulatory agent, are the mainstay of treatment for patients whether they're transplant ineligible or not. Certainly for more frail patients or patients who are of more advanced age, I think using lenalidomide with dexamethasone or bortezomib with dexamethasone alone would be more appropriate. But again, I don't think you have to be dogmatic about it. With the results of the Maya trial that were presented at ASH last year and published recently, we now have a new regimen that I think is very exciting and promising, and that's daratumumab, monoclonal 38 antibody, in combination with lenalidomide and dexamethasone. So it's nice to have more options for treatment of newly diagnosed myeloma patients. One nice thing about daratumumab as compared with bortezomib is we don't see the neuropathy that we do with bortezomib. So it's nice to have that as an option for patients who are more frail. the standard triplet would be the proteasome inhibitor and IMiD combination. So the most common one that we see used is lenalidomide, bortezomib, and dexamethasone, or RVD. But there's other iterations of that. So ixazomib, or Ninlaro, which is an oral proteasome inhibitor, can also be combined with lenalidomide and dexamethasone for an all-oral triplet. And then we talked a little bit earlier about daratumumab with lenalidomide and dexamethasone. In general, I think the choice of initial treatment should largely be driven, I think, by comorbidities, ability to receive therapy. It is nice to have more options, but sometimes it can make things more confusing. And in the absence of, say, a frontline study comparing RVD to DRD, I think it would be disingenuous that we know for sure which one is better. However, I think it'd be reasonable to say that both would be reasonable options for patients to receive. Venetoclax, which is an oral BCL-2 inhibitor, showed a lot of promise in multiple myeloma when they presented the data at ASH a couple of years ago, showing a 40% overall response rate of patients who harbored a translocation 1114 by FISH. So this led to several further studies. The Bellini trial, which you mentioned, was a randomized study for patients with relapsed multiple myeloma who did not have to have a translocation 1114, although many did, comparing venetoclax with bortezomib and dexamethasone versus bortezomib and dexamethasone alone. this study was halted earlier this year when it was discovered that there was an increased risk of death for patients receiving venetoclax and bortezomib as compared with bortezomib and dexamethasone alone. I still think this drug, despite the shortcomings that were seen in the Bellini trial, has an important role to play for patients with relapsed multiple myeloma. In particular, I think we should try to focus on the translocation 1114 patients. That's where we've seen the highest response rates, and data that's going to be presented at EHA this year shows that those patients did not have that substantial increased risk of death, admittedly a subgroup analysis, but maybe suggestive that a biomarker-driven approach might be more appropriate for using venetoclax. Personally, I've treated a couple of patients with venetoclax, most recently a patient with translocation 1114 and plasma cell leukemia who hadn't responded to anything and has responded beautifully to venetoclax as a single agent. So I do think this drug has an important role to play. I think it'll be important to figure out the data and to determine exactly what went on in the Bellini trial. But I think it would be premature to say that this drug does not have a role, because I think it does.
There is no question that the availability of targeted agents such as FLT3 and IDH1-2 inhibitors has led to survival gains for patients with acute myeloid leukemia. Despite progress made, concerns over the timing and potential toxicities of treatment remain, said Mary Beth Percival, MD. Percival, an assistant member of Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, an assistant professor of hematology and medicine at the University of Washington School of Medicine, and a physician with Seattle Cancer Care Alliance, joined us to discuss advances and challenges with targeted agents in AML and remaining questions in the field.
There are two main approved FLT3 inhibitors right now. One is midostaurin, which is approved for patients who are newly diagnosed with AML. It has not had a lot of experience in the relapsed refractory setting. Because that came out and there was so much interest and trials being focused on that particular drug, the follow-on drugs, the so-called second-generation FLT3 inhibitors, have really focused primarily up to this point on relapsed or refractory patients. So the second drug that's approved for the treatment of FLT3-mutated AML is gilteritinib, and that's really only approved right now for patients who have relapsed or refractory FLT3-mutated AML. So there is an ongoing study that will open soon that's going to compare gilteritinib and midostaurin up front for the treatment of FLT3 mutated AML, but right now they're pretty separate in terms of the population that you would think about using them in based on the population that they've been studied in. There are two drugs that are approved right now that are IDH inhibitors. The first drug is approved for IDH1 mutated AML. That's ivosidenib. It's actually approved for newly diagnosed patients as well as relapsed or refractory patients. And then the second drug is enasidenib, which is approved for IDH2 mutated AML. There is talk that there is kind of a pan IDH inhibitor that's being studied right now, but it's definitely still in preclinical phases, and I don't know whether it's going to be used in AML or whether in other tumors that have also IDH mutations like glioblastoma and things like that. Yeah, it creates a lot of challenges in terms of how to treat patients. And when you see a newly diagnosed patient, should you wait for things like their FLT3 status to come back before you assign a treatment because you want to make sure that you're including something that has a FLT3 inhibitor such as midostaurin? It also makes it challenging for physicians in the community who see a newly diagnosed patient and want to start treatment maybe right away for somebody who has a really high white blood cell count. So I think that the time stuff is an issue. Insurance approval can also be an issue because some of the drugs are really expensive. And so that makes it very challenging with a lot of back and forth between the physician and their staff and trying to advocate on behalf of their patient. And then I think that it's also challenging because some of the new drugs have a lot of side effects and we're only starting to become aware of some of them. I mentioned the differentiation syndrome with the IDH inhibitors that may be occurring a lot more than we expect it to. And frankly, it's kind of surprising when you think about the function of the IDH protein in the cell to think about exactly what's going on to lead to that differentiation syndrome. It's also not as classic as the differentiation syndrome that's seen in a disorder like another blood cancer like APL, where we have a really well stratified time when it occurs and know how to treat it. That's not really the case for patients with the differentiation syndrome with IDH inhibitors. It can occur up to 3 months after they start the drug, and we don't really know what the best way to treat it is. It will probably include steroids, but we don't know for sure.
Finally, Chaitra S. Ujani, MD, came by to explain that PI3 kinase inhibitors, BTK inhibitors, and EZH2 inhibitors have taken greater precedence in the field of follicular lymphoma in recent years. Listen on to hear Ujani, an associate member in the Clinical Research Division at Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, a clinical associate professor of medical oncology at the University of Washington School of Medicine, and a physician with Seattle Cancer Care Alliance, discuss the various therapeutic classes and agents that are showing the most promise in the field of follicular lymphoma.
PI3 kinase inhibitors, it's an interesting class of drugs because they do target a pathway downstream of the B-cell receptor. And we know the B-cell receptor to be tonically active in follicular lymphoma. So the first PI3 kinase inhibitor to be approved was adalimumab. It's an inhibitor of the delta isoform of PI3 kinase. And that approval came based on a study that was published about 5 years ago, showing a response rate about 50% in patients with previously treated follicular lymphoma. Now these patients were pretty heavily pretreated, had to receive prior rituximab and an alkylating agent. The thing about adalimumab, it is associated with some side effects. So it's known for colitis, pneumonitis, and AST and ALT elevations, and actually has a black box warning for opportunistic infections as well. So it's nice to have options in terms of PI3 kinase inhibitors. The second generation inhibitors, they differ a little bit in their structure and their inhibition of PI3 kinase. So we have duvelisib, which is a delta gamma inhibitor, copanlisib, which is an alpha delta inhibitor. Duvelisib's orally available, bioavailable. It was approved recently based on the Dynamo study with a response rate of about 42%, median PFS of a little over 8 months. Copanlisib was approved based on the Kronos 1 study. In this particular phase 2 study, the response rate was a little bit higher, 59%. However, we can't compare these trials directly head to head, but it was a similar population previously treated with rituximab and chemotherapy. In this study, patients had a little bit longer median PFS of a little over 11 months. And then there are newer generation PI3 kinase inhibitors that are coming out. Umbralisib is an interesting one. It's an oral agent just dosed once a day. Doesn't seem to have as much of the colitis and pneumonitis and AST, ALT elevations as adalimumab. There was a PI3 kinase inhibitor from MEI Pharma that was presented at ASCO just over the weekend, which actually showed some pretty striking activity. Response rates close to 80%, which is impressive in this class of drugs. Ibrutinib has shown response rates about 20-40% in the phase 2 setting. Acalabrutinib is a second generation PI3, a second generation BTK inhibitor, but I feel like there's been more data with zanubrutinib. So zanubrutinib is a little bit different than ibrutinib in the sense that it's thought to be a little bit more selective for BTK, and hopefully with that has less side effects. It's dosed twice a day, and there's been some interesting data with that in combination with anti-CD20 monoclonal antibodies, it'll be interesting to see where this doublet goes. I think the real value of tazemetostat is in patients who have the activating mutation of EZH2. And as you can see in those patients who had that mutation, the response rates are quite impressive, over 80%. So that is a mutation I think that patients will hopefully in the future be screened for, and therefore we can then create a more personalized regimen for the patients. And for the folks who don't have the mutation, we know that the activity is relatively modest, and it's not worth offering that drug to them.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to OncLive On Air. Check back on Wednesdays for new interviews from our State of the Science summits. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. We have two upcoming State of the Science summits for those interested in attending. If you'd like to learn more about cutting-edge treatment strategies in genitourinary cancer, register for the October 22nd State of the Science Summit in Phoenix, Arizona. We'll also be holding a State of the Science Summit on breast cancer on October 23rd in White Plains, New York. Register now at onclive.com/meetings/SOSS. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so you get a notification every time a new episode's posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.